I feel like we kind of need a quick little recap of where we're at now with the book of Numbers, because it's been a little while since we've been there. They've gotten the clearance to head back into the promised land. Everything seems to be fine. People seem to be following along. They're not going to do it perfectly. It's kind of like life. We can go for some good stretches being really obedient and following God, and then we lapse at on occasion. And so that's where we find these guys. And Numbers 26 is, again, one of the reason why the book of Numbers is called the book of Numbers. There are two censuses that are taken, one in Numbers chapter 1 and one in Numbers 26, where we're at right now. And what they're trying to do is God is trying to say, look, you are now getting ready for battle, so we need to count everyone so you guys are prepared to enter into the land and engage in the battle that we need to be fighting in. Of course, I'm sure for some people, they're a little bit worried, because remember, they've done 40 years around the Sinai Peninsula. Essentially, everyone who came the first time to the edge of the promised land is now going to be dead. Remember, there's only a couple of people who have survived, Joshua and Caleb, and Moses is about to take off as well. And it's going to take a while for them to actually enter into the promised land. It's very helpful for me to try and figure out chronology and what the books actually mean. Numbers is going to take us all the way through this final moment of Moses. The entire book of Deuteronomy is Moses' last speech. And like most pastors, they can become long-winded. And so he goes for chapter after chapter after chapter. And it's finally at the end of the book of Deuteronomy that Moses ends up back up on the mountain and he dies. So we're talking a very, very short time span between Numbers 26 and the end of Deuteronomy. Joshua, the book of Joshua, is when they finally enter into the promised land. So now they're going to do a census, and we're only going to read a couple of the opening verses of Numbers 26. After the plague, the Lord said to Moses and Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, take a census of the whole Israelite community by families, all those 20 years old or more who were able to serve in the army of Israel. So on the plains of Moab, by the Jordan, across from Jericho, Moses and Eleazar, the priest, spoke with them and said, take a census of the men, 20 years old or more, as the Lord commanded. Now, you can go through if you want to. I did. I was looking at numbers and all that stuff. But if you start flipping forward, you're going to see that this is about 62 verses of luscious numbers. And if you are a math person, maybe that's something that will interest you. But there isn't really anything truly exciting in that section. What we do find out is a couple of things. We find out, one, that there were some clans took bigger hits than others. The clan that took the biggest hit, the biggest loss, was the tribe of Simeon. They lost 37,000 people, and that was because they were initially part of the major rebellions. They hadn't had a chance to catch up. Manasseh had the greatest gains. But if you put the chart side by side, you'll find out that they have just about the same number of people as they had when they were about to enter the first time. Which, again, is a great lesson that you may try to thwart God's will, but it's really difficult to do. God is a very patient God, and he's promised them that they're going to enter into the promised land. And if it takes them 40 years for them to actually accomplish it, then he's okay with waiting. And that's why at the end of this whole cycle, it's essentially the same number of people are coming into the land. That's Numbers 26. Was that the fastest chapter I've ever done in my entire life? Yes, it was. Numbers 27. We get two stories that I think are really, really important. Do you guys ever get sick of being asked questions? Sometimes, I put it in the little email, like, paper or plastic? Do you want your Caesar dressing on the side? And of course, every parent's most favorite question, every night at right around 5 o'clock, what are we having for dinner? I swear, if I don't ever hear that question again, I'd be happy. I've tried to teach my kids, don't ask me that question, because about 3/4 of the time, I actually don't know the answer to that question. But it's constant. I've always been curious if I sat down and actually counted the amount of times people have asked questions throughout the day, how many questions would that be? It happens all over the place. Sometimes we get to a point where we get a little tired of it. Moses is the leader of this Israelite group. A while back, he got into trouble because he was the head judge. He was the one that was going to give all of the rulings on any questions, whether they were theological or whether they were practical. People were coming to him constantly. It was one of those things, you can almost imagine the holiday scene. He's hanging out with his family, and they're like, all right, Moses, you got to go because there's work to be done. And you could just hear him groaning and sobbing over, oh, I've got to listen to people and all of their weird questions again. And that's when his father-in-law, Jethro, steps up and says, dude, why are you taking all the questions? You need to appoint some people who have the Spirit of God in them and who are able to answer questions that are a little bit easier, and then reserve yourself for the very difficult questions. And that seemed to work, and it appears that that's what happens at this case too. We're going to read about Zelophehad's daughters and the situation they find themselves. I've actually changed my thinking on this particular section just ever so slightly. At first, I thought that the question that was posed to Moses by Zelophehad's daughters was an easy question to answer. In fact, I'll pose the question to you when we get to it, and you will come up with the same answer that God gives. But what's interesting is I didn't realize what a sticky question it actually is because of something that then happens in Numbers 36. We're going to see the same question show back up again. So Moses now gets approached by Zelophehad's daughters. The daughters of Zelophehad, son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, belonged to the clans of Manasseh, son of Joseph. The names of the daughters were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. I'm not going to make any jokes on that because I think I've made them before. They approached the entrance to the tent of meeting and stood before Moses. So they've come with a theological question. They've come with a very important question. They said, our father died in the desert. He was not among Korah's followers who banded together against the Lord, but he died for his own sin and left no sons. Why should our father's name disappear from the clan because he had no son? Give us property among our father's relatives. So the point that they're asking is, look, we're all sisters here. Dad had no sons. And at that point, none of the women were married. So they all came to Moses and said, we are supposed to be given an allotment of land. What's going to happen to the land because our father died and we've got nothing then? We got to go back a little bit to some other passages to help us understand it. First of all, in Leviticus 25, God said, when you get to the land, the land is going to be one of the fulfillment of the promises that's really important. They were told, you're going to enter into this land flowing with milk and honey. You're going to have all of this separation. You're going to have your own plot of land for you to do with however you wish to do. And that the land that was given to you was given to you in perpetuity. In other words, you could not lose your land. We don't do that nowadays. If I have a house and I'm going to move somewhere else, I can sell the house and the property goes to some other person and now they legally own the house. The Israelites never did that. They practice leasing. So let's say I'm in a little bit of a difficulty financially and I need to make some more money. I might go to my neighbors, Alan and Irene, and say, I've got this property and I would like to give it to you for you to work. I will work the land and I will become like your employee and work that way, and then you could help me get out of debt. That was the arrangement, because in Leviticus 25, it talks about what's called the year of Jubilee. The year of Jubilee was very important. What it said was, in the 50th year, you just count out 50 years each time, and in the 50th year, all land goes back to its original owner. So in the 50th year, I would celebrate because I could go to Al and Irene and say, thank you very much. I want my land back, and I get it back, and it was this big celebration, and everyone was happy. Land was never allowed to be transferred to another person except for the short term. And even if you read through Leviticus 25, it's very interesting because it says, make arrangements. Like, could you imagine if I go to Alan and Irene and it's year 49? How much money are you going to give me to use my land for 1 year? It's going to be less than if it was year one. And even God lays it out saying, make sure that you're not taking advantage one of another. Count out the years and make adjustments because the land has to revert back to its original owner. I'm still living in the land. It's still, well, you're making money off the land because maybe I'm farming the land, and now you technically get the spoils, but you're going to pay me a salary or you're going to pay me up front to pay my debt, and that's how I then work it off. But I know that in the 50th year, regardless of how bad things went, the land comes back to me. That's why this was important. This was also a male-driven society in the fact that the land was connected to the male. So what would happen to the female? Well, Melissa's father would be like, well, I'm going to set some money aside, and depending upon how pretty she is, it will be commensurate with her looks and her desirability. And actually, if you had wide hips, so you could be a good birthing mom. And so this value would be given, and the money would be given to you. You would actually hold on to it. And what would happen is, when the time came for her to marry Bob, the money would be given to Bob's parents, saying, here you go now. You now get this money. And it's kind of like this wonderful transaction. We call it the dowry. And that's just how it worked. Land was never supposed to be any transaction in this, because when Melissa ends up marrying Bob, Melissa is no longer a part of her original family. She now goes and lives with Bob at Bob's place, and whatever tribe Bob belongs to is whatever tribe Bob belongs to. And if you're two different tribes, you've left your tribe and you are now solely and focused on that one particular tribe. That's how they set things up. That's why this question that Zelophehad's daughters is a complicated question. At first, it seems a little bit easy. In fact, I'll just ask you. Women come, say, Dad died, and now we don't have any land. Can we have the land that our father had? You would simply say, yeah, I mean, it seems like a reasonable request, right? You know, they're not asking for the moon. They're just asking, can we have the land that belongs to us, because we're unmarried, we don't have a dowry, and we're not going to be married off. And so that should be a really simple question, but it's complicated because of the land issue. A couple of things that I find really interesting about this particular thing. First of all, I love these ladies because they are, in fact, women of faith. Had they entered into the promised land yet? Did they own any land yet? But they're acting as if they already have got it. I love that thought. Now, again, if we go allegorical, the promised land for a Christian is equivalent to heaven. And so what they're saying is, look, I want to live now as if the promise has already been fulfilled and I'm already victorious. And of course, then the question is posed to us, is that how we live? Do we live in such a way as if we've already won? Because I don't see that a lot, to be honest. I see it every now and then when people's faith gets completely bolstered up and they get so excited and they just know that they know that they know that everything's going to be fine, because at the end of the day, no matter what happens, they're going to heaven. Why don't we live like that more often? Why is it that we're constantly reminded of our frailty to a point that we often live defeated lives? Now, again, I'm not saying, you know, put on a smile and act like Pollyanna and act as if nothing is wrong, because there is bad stuff that happens. But for a lot of people, I think we would be better served if we looked at our situation and said, you know what, I can handle whatever situation comes my way, because I know at the end of the day, I'm going to heaven. And whatever happens to me now is actually irrelevant. It could be good. It could be bad. I'm not going to allow my emotional circumstances to be dictated by the stuff that I'm experiencing. Because we all go through ups and downs. We all go through valleys and peaks. Sometimes those valleys are significant and they last a long time. Sometimes those mountaintop experiences last for a while. But let's face it, it always changes. That's how life goes. Learning how to live with a long point of view, saying it doesn't really matter because ultimately I'm going to be victorious. That's what I love about these women. I think it's a great lesson for us as well. The other thing that they bring up, which is it's a minor point, but I'm fascinated by it. They talk about how their father died for his own sin and he was not a part of Korah's rebellion. It doesn't specifically say it, but it seems to be that it was more like a common knowledge or something that would just be agreed upon as a society, that if someone committed such a heinous offense, that their land could actually be taken from them. This is the reason why, if you want to write it down in your Bible, I did, Korah's Rebellion. Where is that? Naboth's Vineyard. 1 Kings 21. 1 Kings 21, we hear of this really interesting story where there's this nasty, evil queen, and her name has become synonymous with evil. Her name is Jezebel, and she really wanted this guy's vineyard that was right next door, and he even goes to the guy and says, hey, really like your place. It's really quaint. It's right near my palace. Can I buy it from you? Full market value. I really want to plant a vegetable garden there. And Naboth says, no, that's my land. And remember, land is important. And it was really obvious that she wasn't going to be giving him another piece of property. There was no property spot. That was his land. That was his in perpetuity. Of course, the question then, where is he going to go? He can't buy someone else's land because they're going to say, well, I'll rent it to you for 50 years, but then I get it back. He would actually become homeless. So he looks at him and says, no, I don't think so. I'm going to reject this. And Jezebel goes out and trumps up charges of blasphemy in order to get him killed so that she can then take his property. So it seems to be that there are certain circumstances that they could lose the rights of their promised land promise. And what these women are saying is, there should be no issue here. My dad wasn't a part of Korah's rebellion. He just died because he died. He ate way too many hamburgers. And so he just passed away. And so we need this land. So now we get the question of, what does Moses do? I've got to remember who Moses is. I'm sorry. Who is Moses? Moses was an interesting cat because he was one of the only people that had this designation that he could speak to God face to face. And you're like, wait a second, I thought there was, no one could see God and live. No one except for Moses. Moses had this relationship unlike any other. Remember, he was the one that goes up onto the mountaintop, and when he comes down, he's actually glowing, right? The pictures are appropriate. We got a glowing Moses. Yeah, your job as a congregation is to carry AA batteries with you wherever you go. For those of you listening online, my batteries died. So what was that? Well, I thought I hit pause, but I didn't. It's still recording. So people are listening online going, wow, that was a big long gap. The gap was because my batteries ran out. Okay. What was that? You'll edit the file? Oh, fantastic. Ray's good at that kind of stuff. So, all right. And break. Moses was glowing. Thank you. I wasn't quite sure where I was at. So Moses is glowing. He's one of those guys that he has to wear a veil now when he would show up because people are like, dude, man, you are like way too bright. It actually changed his physical appearance because he was in the presence of God. How often did he speak to God? He spoke to God on a regular basis. If there was anyone who could answer the question instantaneously, I think it'd be Moses, right? I mean, you guys answered the question instantaneously. Should the women receive the property? It was like a no-brainer, right? We're like, yeah, give it to them. How often do we answer questions like that in real life? All the time. In fact, for some people, they pride themselves that when a question is given, an instantaneous answer means that the person is filled with wisdom. And I'm going to give the challenge that maybe that's not the case. But the person that gives an instantaneous answer may be filled with more pride than anything else. Of all the people that could have answered the question instantaneously, it would have been Moses. But what does Moses do? Verse 5, so Moses brought their case before the Lord. Whoa. That's pretty amazing. Again, at first blush, we look at these questions and we think it's easy, but we don't really know the full ramifications. Moses understands that sometimes there's questions that are behind the questions and there's sometimes more complicated things that are going on, and he never presumed to just simply give an answer. He seems to be one of those guys that says, let me pray about that. Is that your default answer when questions are given? Now, again, I don't want this to become too laborious. I don't know, maybe we'll try this in our household. Mom, Dad, what's for dinner? Let me pray about that. Or I could ask someone and say, why don't you pray about that? See what God, he'd be like, we prayed about it, God said McDonald's. Yeah, that's what my kids would say every single time. Rotten children. What's that? Nothing. Oh, what? I always say when they ask me what's for dinner, I always say food because I figure that's a safe answer. Just say food. Then they ask what kind of food, and I say good food. And then, you know, then they realize that. I don't want us to get into something like that, like you're waking up in the morning like, well, what should I wear today? Let me pray about this and let me see if I can find out. I think it could become too laborious, but I'm also not saying that we swing it the other way, too. Like you're about to make a decision about what college you want to go into. Well, okay, I don't know. Do you need to then, you know, call everyone up and have a three-hour prayer marathon? That might possibly help, but maybe it's just as simple as sitting down for 5 minutes and saying, Lord, I'm really struggling with this. We often don't do that. If I was talking to a person going into college, what is my typical answer when they say, well, what college should I go to? I'm going to say, well, you know, get a little spreadsheet out, you know, write pros and cons and the cost and where it's located and does it have your major and list everything out. And where in there is pray? It's usually not. What should I do about changing my jobs? Well, I don't know. Is the job you're going to go to, is it going to pay more money? Are you going to be away from your family more often? Will you have to move? Will you have to commute? Do you have a car that can support the commute? Put all the things out and then look at it and make a decision. Well, where in there is the decision to pray? I think we sometimes shy away from that for some reason because we feel as if God should have already given us the wisdom and the knowledge, but how often have I found that God doesn't give it to us so that we can actually become dependent upon him so we can learn something? I think that's a better lesson. I think that's what Moses is really trying to lay out here. Moses asked. He could have given the snap answer. He was qualified to do so. Maybe they would have thought he was a great leader, like, wow, we brought our case before Moses, and he just, boom, gave us an answer, and off we went. I know that there's some things that deserve quick answers. Should I punish my child by putting them in an oven and cooking them? I should pray about it. Yeah. Depends which child. So you have it large enough to fit the child. We have certain things. Or should I didn't get a chance to study for my test, so maybe I should cheat. I'm going to give you a quick answer. No, don't do it. There are certain things that I think we can give those quick answers. Where God has already revealed what is right and what is wrong. And when we go to God and ask those types of questions, I think what we're looking for is a loophole. But I'm talking about other things that maybe aren't quite so black and white. I thought of one the other day. It actually happened because Heather and I were at a restaurant. So if you go to a restaurant, let's say like a fast food place, and a guy orders, like let's say it's my case, I ordered a water, and then my wife orders a soda. Should I fill up soda in my water cup? No, because what would we call that? That's stealing. But that one's pretty easy. Well, what if I have water, she has soda, and I drink some of her soda? Is that okay? Out of her cup? As long as she doesn't refill it. Okay, because then, yeah, because here was the thing, and I actually thought about it as we're leaving. We're getting ready to go, and I'm, and just so you know, it's going to be now for posterity. My New Year's resolution is actually to drink more water. I don't think I drink enough water, and so when I go places, I'm just going to drink more water. So I'm actually trying this out. So I have water, and she has a soda, and we're getting ready to leave. And as we're leaving, she says, I'm done drinking soda. Would you like me to refill this and give this to you? Is that stealing? No, I didn't throw my wife under the bus. I threw myself under the bus because I'm going to tell you what we did. We did it. She refilled it with soda, and I drank it. And I was like, well, because it's like if we're leaving, and then if we had gotten in the car, and then we started drinking it, you know, and she was done. We're talking about certain situations are not quite black and white, are they? Certain things, and I actually believe that that's where most people live. I think most people live in gray areas, not in black and white. The younger you are, the more black and white everything is. You talk to young people, right? Especially young adults, 20-year-olds. They're like, no, this is it. This is right. This is wrong. Done. I had a long argument one time with a guy on whether or not birth control was acceptable by God. And he was a 20-year-old. And he was like, no, 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 no. It's wrong. It's bad. God says no. You're sinning if you're using it. And then it's funny because I talked to him relatively recently and I asked him about it. And now he's married and he has a couple kids. And he's like, well, I'm not quite as dogmatic as I was before on this particular instance, because I think that's really where most people live. We live in this gray area. And again, most of the times, I think that we just simply operate under our own wisdom and knowledge. Moses gives us a different model. Maybe we should pray about it. Maybe what we're doing is wrong. Maybe what we're doing is quite all right. Maybe we need to talk to some other people and get some collective wisdom. Maybe we need to just take, I'm not talking a 3-hour prayer marathon. What if it was just a quick 30 seconds, like, Lord, I need help. Here's a situation that I'm going through. Can you please give me wisdom? Will God honor that? Oh, absolutely. Sam. Yes, yes. We don't want to ask. Because for most of us, we already know the answer before we've even asked it. But we're hoping that there's a loophole. Like, I'm sure these women would have loved if Moses just said, yeah, sure. I'm sure that would have been a snap decision, and it seems logical. Yeah, and I'm sure at this point, as Moses is like, let me pray about it, they're like, oh, man, are you kidding me? You're going to bring God into this whole thing? Well, God, because interestingly enough, Leviticus 25 has already spoken. Leviticus 25 and the rest of Leviticus has already said women get no property rights. It belongs with the men. It was the easiest way to track things. Women got their property rights either through their father or through their husband, and that just kept it clean and easy. It wasn't sexist. It wasn't supposed to be like oppressive to women. It was just easier. And so he could have just simply said, look, ladies, this question's been answered. Get out of here. He could have also said, oh, that sounds like a great idea to me. I would have come to Moses, because this is what my wife does. She loves to come to me with questions, big, important questions, like right about 10 o'clock at night. Have you ever noticed that? Oh, yeah. Oh, you love to ask questions. I'm sorry I'm throwing you under the bus. But women, it is not fair for you to ask important questions at 10 o'clock at night. Amen. Because no guy is awake. And really all we're going to do is we're going to agree to whatever you want so that we can go to bed. I think that's why you do it. Yeah, exactly. Get back to Zelophehad's daughters. I'm really amazed at what he's about to do with going to God. Have you encountered stuff in your life where you go, wow, this one's a tough one? If I ask my pastor, he may give me an answer I don't like. If I ask my friends, maybe they'll give me an answer I do like. If I go to God, who knows what answer I'm going to get? And even if you think you already know what the answer is going to be, I still think it's probably smart to ask. George. Right, yeah. I think that's the reason why originally this seems like such an easy question. Right, right. I think this is the reason why in the New Testament, all of a sudden, some people said, I think it's okay that we start eating meat. And some people are like, whoa, 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 God has already spoken on this subject. And yet now there's something that has been changed on this. And they had to go back to God. Is this true or is this not? Don't ever be afraid of the answer that's good. First of all, if you're asking a question that you already know the answer to, then just don't ask the question. I'm really tired of answering those questions, okay? I'm just kidding. But I've had that where people come, right? Teenagers do it all the time, right? What is the question that all teenagers ask with their boyfriends and girlfriends? How far is too far? Well, if you've asked the question, you've already gone too far. If you're wondering about something and you feel uncomfortable about it, then chances are it's probably wrong. I always say that could you feel comfortable doing it in church? The action that you're talking about it, could you do that in church? Then at that point, it makes things really... We sometimes ask those questions, but there's other times when I don't think it's really that clear. So let's see what actually happens here with good old Zelophehad's daughters. Moses brought their case before the Lord. And the Lord said to him, what Zelophehad's daughters are saying is right. You must certainly give them property as an inheritance among their father's relatives and turn their father's inheritance over to them. And then he gives us clarification. Say to the Israelites, if a man dies and leaves no son, turn his inheritance over to his daughter. If he has no daughter, give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, give his inheritance to the father's brothers. If his father has no brothers, give his inheritance to the nearest relative in the clan that he may possess it. This is a legal requirement for the Israelites, as the Lord commanded Moses. I think that sometimes we're given rules or laws, and then it's just the living out or the application of those. I think that's the reason why sometimes churches end up overstepping some of the boundaries that were given, because some things are not quite too clear. Is it appropriate that husbands should love their wives? Do we have that as an axiom, as a law? Yeah, that's husbands love your wives. Wives respect your husbands. All right, there's no question about it. Now the question comes in, how do I actually do it? And that's where God is silent. I think sometimes churches overreach because they say, well, just do X, Y, and Z, and I've got a nice 5-point sermon for you on this marriage series, and just do this, this, and this. Thus saith the Lord. No, 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 no. The Lord doth not saith this. The Lord gives a command. The application can sometimes be difficult. Is it good to give advice? Is it good to say, yes, do this? I do counseling a lot. I do a lot of premarital counseling. And I do the same thing with my couples. I'll tell them, there are certain things that I believe is absolutely important of how to live. Like, should you forgive someone who has hurt you? Okay, now I go back to Scripture and I say, yes, that's a clear-cut answer. How does that actually practically work itself out? Well, now I'm just going to have to give you tips or advice that seems to coincide with what Scripture actually says without breaking what Scripture says. But has God commanded that? No. So we always got to be careful. I think that's the reason why I like Moses. Like, I don't know. Let me get back to you on that. And I think that's where most of us really should be living in. Yes? Okay. They got five daughters. Five daughters. And they own a piece of property, right?
Okay, what happens if one daughter gets married?
Okay, see, you are like the perfect mind for this, right? Like, well, what if we do this? Well, what about this, this, and this? And we start extrapolating out, what are the problems? That's exactly what Numbers 36 does. Numbers 36, we're going to come back to Zelophehad's daughters because the tribe of Manasseh, because remember, that's where they're from, the tribe of Manasseh, they come to Moses and they're like, well, okay, hold on a second here, because you've just now given this piece of property to these five women. Well, what happens if they get married? What happens if this lady from the tribe of Manasseh here goes and marries from the tribe of Reuben over there? Does the land go over and is now Reuben's land? If you do that, then us as a tribe collectively will actually be damaged in this whole process because our tribe is going to lose land in the process. That's why it's not a clear answer. That's why Moses prayed about it, because of this particular sticky wicket. So what's the answer to that? Well, you have to wait till Numbers 36. We're not there yet. But I'll preach about this. I already know the answer myself. You probably could come up with the answer yourselves too. Don't tell them. But just read Numbers 36 and you'll be like, oh, well, now I know the answer. But this is the reason why we should be asking about it. Like, how does this practically work out? How often do we actually say, Lord, I want to live my life in glory to you. How do I actually do that? What should I say? What should I do? How should I live? How should I treat my wife or my girlfriend? How should I treat my son or my daughter? How do I treat my parents properly? We know we're supposed to respect our parents. Well, how does that work out? What if my parent does this, this, or this? Well, maybe here's a good response. What if my parent does this, this, or this? Maybe here's a good. What if my spouse does this or this? How do I react? Well, maybe here's some good ideas. We should be always going back to God. I think personally, I rely too much on my own wisdom because I really think I'm smart. And I shouldn't. I should actually be going back to God more often. So that's the trend. So Zelophehad's daughters, they get the, oh, and by the way, some people blame the Bible for sexism. Do you know how radical of a thought this would be to actually give women property? Some people don't realize it, but the Bible is chock full of things like that. Now, some people say, well, the Bible reports these tragedies or these travesties against women. The Bible isn't commanding it. It's just simply reporting what culture does. There are cultures even today where women have about the same amount of rights as they had back in the times of the Bible. But that's not here. Now, am I saying everything's perfect? No, absolutely not. We always have ways to go and better ways we handle one another. But let me tell you, the Bible is the one that actually started pressing a lot of these social issues. It was radical that Jesus had women disciples. Did you know he had women disciples? We often think of only the 12 disciples. Well, the 12 were like the real close people. But it talks extensively about hundreds of other disciples that he had, and some of them were women. How many rabbis do you know nowadays that have female disciples? Jesus broke the mold on that. Here, women have property rights. Who was the first person that Jesus showed up to after he rose from the dead? A woman. Wow. So I get really offended whenever I hear, you know, that Christianity is, you know, slams women or oppresses them. I don't think it does. I think how maybe some people have interpreted things. This is a real radical concept. Yes. Lynn. Yes, the Bible is not sexist, it's orderly, yeah. Yeah, and that's me. I'm in charge. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, no, it is true. You know, I'm going to be honest. I think I've said this before. That's why military is really interesting to me because military is all about order. You outrank me. Why? Because you're better than me? No, you just, that's just how it is. It's just structured that way. It's not making any claims on other people. Yeah. So order is good because God is a God of order. All right, I want to get to this Joshua to succeed Moses. Again, I'm fascinated by the fact of this particular paragraph sets up then, it can't be that long. It's got to be less than a year between Numbers 27, halfway through, and the end of Deuteronomy. Listen to what happens. The Lord said to Moses, go up the mountain in the Abiram range and see the land I've given the Israelites. After you've seen it, you too will be gathered to your people as your brother Aaron was. For when the community rebelled at the waters of the desert of Zin, both of you disobeyed my command to honor me as holy before their eyes. These were the waters of Meribah, Kadesh, and the desert of Zin. Do you remember the story? They're in this place and they need some water. And so the first time God had told Moses years and years and years ago, strike a rock and water's going to come forth. And this time God says, you know what, I've changed things up. Don't strike the rock. Just talk to the rock and the rock will produce water for you. But Moses goes on this tirade where you can tell he's angry. He is now fed up and he wants nothing to do with these people anymore. And he yells at them about how disobedient they are and how much God hates them. And then he grabs his staff and he hits the rock. And I think in kind of a humorous thing, the first time doesn't work. And then he does it again and the water comes out and God says, you misrepresented me, man. I'm not some angry God that just wants to smoke these people. I gave you a command. It was rather simple. It was rather easy to obey, but you didn't. Because of this, you won't enter the land. You'll see it. You'll be taken up to a mountain. You'll be able to see everything. And then you'll be taken away. It's very mysterious. We don't know exactly what happened in the fulfillment in Deuteronomy at the end. Like I said, God gives this command, come up and do this. But then before Moses does this, he gives these super duper long speeches, which is the rest of Numbers and then all the way in through Deuteronomy. And then he finally does go up on the mountain at the end of Deuteronomy, and he's taken up. And apparently then there was a fight. A fight broke out between Michael the archangel and the devil over Moses' body. And we only know this because of the book of Jude, which tells this interesting story that we don't know. We don't know some of the mechanics, but we do know this. Was Moses sent to hell? No, I hope not, because he shows up later on the Mount of Transfiguration. But there were consequences to his sin, and the sin was you're not going to be able to see the promised land. You're going to die before this actually happens, which is very interesting that that's kind of like us. We're going to die before we're gathered then to our people. Yes, Jim. Well, yeah, that was the thing. There was something happened, and there was a dispute over the body between Michael the angel and Moses. Right, what does that mean?
In the physical world, it was never found.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he was taken up. It was kind of very Elijah-ish, and that's the reason why some people talk about the Mount of Transfiguration where Moses and Elijah show up. It's because these are two buddies that had very unique deaths. Yeah, I personally would love to die that way. Lord, yeah. You want to just like take me. Yeah, don't let me die and then do it, but that's how, for us, the rest of it goes. Yeah. Sam? Right, yeah, and that's where we don't push the allegory too far, because it's just, maybe at that point, maybe allegory is probably the wrong word, an analogy. Yeah, we don't want to push the analogy too far, because if that analogy were true, it'd be like, all right, Moses, you get to see heaven, but you ain't going into heaven. Sorry, buddy. that'd really stink for him. So, Moses, you're going to be taken up on this mountain. Verse 15. How would you respond to this? You're Moses, and you've just been told, yeah, you had to bring these people out of Egypt. You had to walk with them all these years, and they still whined and complained. And at the end of it, you came this close to walking in, but you missed it. How would you respond to that? Yes, Dave. Are you kidding me? Like, seriously, who would make a second appeal? Who would say, God, reconsider? Yeah, I think that, and I also probably would have launched into a dissertation of how I remained good in the face of all of these evil people. And Lord, these people, like, they tested my patience and they annoyed me to no end. You've got to let me in. I would have brought that up. I'd be like, God, you wanted these people smoked. Right? I stood up for them. I protected them. That's got to count for something. Moses' response is very interesting. Moses said to the Lord, "May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all mankind, appoint a man over this community to go out and come in before them, one who will lead them out and bring them in, so that the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd." Whoa. Final thoughts in this man's brain is, Lord, I don't want these people to suffer. And I don't want them to wander around without any sort of leadership. And I don't want them to get lost. Lord, find someone to take my place first so that they don't get lost. I find that incredible. Sam. Exactly. Well, yeah, when Jesus looks out over the Kidron Valley as he's about ready to go to the cross, and he says, "Wow, you are like sheep without a shepherd." I think he's directly quoting from this. Yeah. Amy. Yes. Yeah, and to be thinking about the people, like he was just told, come up to this mountain, look across to the promised land, and then you'll die. Like, he is now facing his own death. And the first thought that runs through his mind is someone else. It's very much like what Jesus did. Yeah. There he is hanging on the cross, about to die, and who is he concerned for? Everyone else. Talking to the thief on the cross next to him, looking down at his mom, and saying, I've got to think about her. Lord, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. He's thinking about everyone else but himself. And I know that I think we would like to be noble, like when it comes to us. Can we think such noble thoughts right before we die? Really, we should be asking that question, can we do that on a daily basis? How often do you think of other people even while you're living? It's easy to get unselfish when you're about to die. It's harder to be unselfish when you're living. I often hear this when husbands talk about their wives and they say something like, I would die for her. And I think we all would. I think most men would be like, give us a choice. Who's going to die? I'll take the hit. But here's a better question. Would I live for her? Would I live my life so that she is taken care of? That's where Moses is really shining through. This is where Jesus shines through. That every day was about other people, not just himself. And I think that maybe we need to be challenged with this new year, where we think we're about other people, but are we about them only when it's convenient for us? Only when it hits us that it's important to do? Or are we always thinking that way constantly? I'm amazed at Moses. I really do see him, when he was a little bit younger, much more of a hothead, filled with a lot of anger and rage. And then as he goes, as Amy says, gets to the point where he's like, I think I know what's important and what's not important. And me being in charge is not important. In fact, I would love to leave this lasting legacy, but it's more important for me to appoint a successor so that things go smoothly, because all he can think about are the people. How are the people going to react to this? Like, do they even know that Moses is going to die? Moses is like, we need to set up a process now. So, verse 18. So the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, son of Nun. So we know he is a Catholic orphan. Did you get, there was two jokes in that one. Did you get both of them? All right, okay, just check. Son of Nun, like, okay, all right. I'll keep moving. I didn't make that joke up. I ripped it off from another pastor. So if you don't like it, blame him. I asked Heather, should I use this joke? And she said, no, it's dumb. But you all laughed. So the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Have him stand before Eleazar the priest and the entire assembly and commission him in their presence. Give him some of your authority so the whole Israelite community will obey him. He is to stand before Eleazar the priest, who will obtain decisions for him by inquiring of the Urim before the Lord, which again is very interesting that the story right before this was Zelophehad's daughters. It's almost as if Moses was teaching Joshua, this is what you got to do now, right? It's not about just you and your wisdom. Go and inquire about God. At his command, he and the entire community of the Israelites will go out, and at his command, they will come in. Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and had him stand before Eleazar the priest and the whole assembly. Then he laid his hands on him and commissioned him as the Lord instructed through Moses. How often are we thinking about other people? And how often do we hope and pray for those around us, whether they're our kids or whether we're a school teacher and they're our school kids or whether they're neighbor kids or just friends? How often are we thinking, Lord, protect them and help them, and if you need to pass stuff off to others, that is the best example of selflessness that you'll ever find. Let's pray. Lord, I confess that I way too often answer questions too quickly, and I do not think about maybe what you would say, especially in sticky stuff. I want to be perceived as wise. I want to be perceived as knowledgeable. But now all I'm doing is taking the focus off of you and putting it onto me. And help us, Lord, to turn to you more often when a decision needs to be made, that we would maybe we just pause for even just 5 seconds and talk to you, or maybe discuss it with other godly people and seek wisdom. Forgive us when we have presumed, what you'd say, because I know there's a lot of damage that has been done in this world in your name that you never, ever sanctioned, that you never, ever wished on other people. I pray that you would give us your Spirit and help us, Lord, to be thinking of others, just as Moses, in the face of his own death, was thinking about all those around him, just as Jesus, in the face of his death, was thinking about everyone else, was thinking about me, was thinking about people sitting here, was thinking about this entire world. Give us that level of selflessness so that others might not wander around like sheep without a shepherd. Thank you for being our shepherd. In Jesus' name, amen. For our time of communion, we're going to do flow through.